most important thing is, and I'm glad to see it, I will commend them after being quite critical of them, is to come out, you know, open up the windows, figure out what happened, be honest, make the personnel changes you need to make, and get people to have confidence in the system, because we need that system to get people to move. My fear is not that, you know, this was an extreme case, but your biggest fear as someone who worries about catastrophe and saving American lives is no one's listening. We're telling them to evacuate and they're not. We're telling them the hurricane's, you know, coming and to leave the coast. They're not. So I want to get confidence in the system, because you got to move people quickly sometimes to save lives.
I'm Shannon Tagawa Mercer, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 23rd, 2018. With the speed of the news cycle, you may have already forgotten that two Saturdays ago, Hawaii woke up to an emergency ballistic missile alert that ended up being a false alarm. Well, we certainly haven't forgotten. Last week, I spoke with experts to answer some of my lingering questions about the chaotic events of last Saturday. First, Jean Park, social media editor at the Washington Post and former Hawaii resident and journalist, joined us to share his perspective on the events of the day. Stefan Haggard, professor of Korea-Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego, helped us better understand how the events related to the geopolitical elephant in the room, our current relationship with North Korea. Next, Juliette Kayem, who served as the Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security for Intergovernmental Affairs and as the first Undersecretary for Homeland Security in Massachusetts, joined us to share her perspective on federal and state roles and responsibilities. Paul Rosenzweig, former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security and Lawfare contributor, added to our understanding of the government's response. And Garrett Graff, journalist and author of the book Raven Rock, answered the question, what would have happened if this hadn't been a false alarm? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 278, What the Heck Happened in Hawaii?
Jean, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. So, Jean, both as a journalist from the Washington Post and also as someone who comes from the Pacific Islands and someone whose mother is in Hawaii, I thought that you would be best situated to describe what happened. So, what happened in Hawaii on Saturday?
Well, I heard about it when I started getting messages on Saturday morning, or Saturday afternoon our time. Someone who works in the state government messaged me, have you heard about this missile thing? And I ignored it, and I didn't, because I didn't know what she was talking about. I went on to try to make my lunch, and I said, wait, what missile thing? And then I searched for missile on Twitter, and I started seeing the people posting the alert. And then I called my mom immediately, because if we have minutes, this might be the last time I can talk to her. God bless her heart. She was already preparing, and she was putting together her emergency kit. And then that was when I saw Congressman Tulsi Gabbard's tweet saying that it was a false alarm. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I didn't question, like her, the timing of her alert. I just liked to hear someone official saying something. And then, so basically what happened is that, so someone in the emergency management agency in Hawaii, they were doing a drill, a standard drill, practicing the alert system. And what's come out since then is that they've had a screenshot of what the user interface of this alert system looks like, and it's just basically a bunch of links, and this person had clicked the wrong one, and then basically sent the alert out to millions of phones across Hawaii. I have a Hawaiian number. I did not get one, so it worked in that regard in terms of like location, and then people started panicking. I started gathering stories from people on the ground who said that they were calling their loved ones. They already immediately FaceTimed with people. Phones were jammed. The 911 system was jammed, of course, as well. I had friends who tried to go along their day. I had one girlfriend who said that she kept on putting on her makeup because she was, quote-unquote, she wasn't about to go down with one winged liner. Another woman said that, that she was disappointed that this juice that she was making might have been her last meal on Earth. There was a viral video of a gentleman putting his children into a manhole, which sounds silly in retrospect, but when you think about it, when you have minutes to act, at least the guy had a plan of action to put his children in a manhole. So it was very frightening, and nobody really had any information. People were checking the local media, but again, this is Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. Typically, I used to be a journalist in Hawaii. And typically, the newsrooms are very much like bare-bones staff. There's usually only one reporter working per news outlet. So this definitely caught them unawares. Normally, they would be notified.
how has the Hawaii government been handling the period of time immediately after the realization that this was a false alarm? Have they, from your perspective and from your contacts in Hawaii, have they been handling it well? Is it still is there still chaos? Is there still tension?
Sure. Vern Miyagi, the director of the State Hawaii Emergency Management Authority, took full responsibility for the mistake. Obviously, it wasn't him, but it was his system and his oversight, and he took complete responsibility over it. Governor David Ige came out right out in a press conference a couple of hours later, and his most important message, it seemed, that he really wanted to hammer home to people is to try to rebuild trust in the system. One thing I can tell you from living in Hawaii, having lived through multiple tsunami warnings and nothing happening as a result, other than like a couple, three feet, four feet waves, I can tell you definitely that there are people there who would lose faith in the system. And I think the Hawaii governor knew that. He's from there too, and that was his strongest message, to make sure that people will continue to have faith in the system. And I don't know how they can rebuild that trust, but they are trying to be as transparent as possible. Like as I mentioned earlier, they did show that screenshot. So it does seem like that they are trying to show exactly what went wrong and what the faults in the system they have.
And then I spoke with Steph Haggard. I thought it would be useful for you to reflect on really the truth behind the fear and tensions. How plausible would an attack from North Korea on Hawaii have been?
Well, first of all, let me say that we often forget that a lot of what the North Koreans say is also for domestic consumption. We assume it's about signals to us. But of course, for a regime that prides itself on having made these strides with respect to the missile and nuclear program, it's great to be able to tell their public that the U.S. is in a panic as a result of their accomplishments. But I think, in fact, Kim Jong-un is surprisingly cautious. And a lot of what he's done is undertake tests, both on the nuclear and missile side, which are very hard for the U.S. to counter. No one's died, for example. I mean, just think of that fact. Despite all these tensions, there haven't been any deaths associated with any of the tests that have been taken so far. And so, I think that the risks of an inadvertent launch on a place like Hawaii wouldn't come out of the blue, but they would probably come in the wake of escalation with the United States, where the United States was contemplating such attacks.
And so the United States has perhaps been contemplating such attacks. Could you describe what those current contemplations are?
Well, obviously, the Trump administration has been quite divided on this issue. And there are two schools of thought on that. One is that it's functional to have a hard line and a soft line simultaneously being broadcast. I'm of the opposite mind, because the hard line, which emphasizes the possibility the U.S. could respond in a preemptive way, it creates what we call crisis instability, which is two parties that basically see preemption as an option. And as you can imagine, two sides that are both thinking that preemption is possible, that's not a stable circumstance. So I think the U.S. always has military options. They're not necessarily good. I think saying that we have military options is worth reminding the North Koreans about. But to really suggest that this is being contemplated seriously, it seems to me, is highly risky in this circumstance.
Taking a step back to the specific event on Saturday, how much do you think that existing geopolitical tensions, the ones that you just described in the escalation of them, played a role in the event itself? Do you ever, I've heard some people talking about how nuclear panic, as the North Korean media describes it, may have exacerbated the situation, but do you think that played a large role at all?
Well, I certainly don't think it played any role in the mistake that was made. I think it probably played a role in the way that the public responded to it. I mean, if there hadn't been tension on the Korean Peninsula, then people probably would have dismissed it more rapidly as a mistake. So in that sense, the background conditions contributed to the panic. If this were a message that said that an incoming missile was coming from Japan or from New Zealand, then obviously no one would have paid attention to it. It would have been identified immediately as a mistake. But the fact that this tension was background noise was important.
And do you think that the way that Hawaii and the federal government later on handled the alert, or the sort of demonstration of our civil defense measures, signaled anything to the international community?
Well, I think it signaled, as other participants have probably said, it signaled the fact that we didn't really have a very coherent plan with what with respect to what people were actually supposed to do in such a case. And of course, we think of a nuclear attack as being completely devastating and everyone dying and blowing up the entirety of Oahu, but that's not the case. I mean, the kill radius of a nuclear weapon is bounded, and you know, there's probably some value to informing people of how they should respond to such a horrific event. And it didn't seem to me that those kinds of precautions were actually in place. So the panic was also associated with the fact that people didn't really know what to do.
There, I've read on Twitter some murmurs making connections between the subsequent false alarm in Japan and the announcement by the NHK that there was an incoming missile. Do you think that there is any connection between the events in Hawaii and the events in Japan?
No, but I think it is worth pointing out that Japan faces much more substantial risk in this regard than the United States does, because even under what I've called this cautious strategy, it's clear that the North Koreans have overflown missiles across Japanese territory, as well as landing to the west of the country. And I think the possibility that one of these missiles could blow up and debris could land in Japan is much, much higher than in the United States. And so I think the risk for Japan is not just about a self-conscious attack, but it's about a missile launch which goes wrong in some way and puts Japanese lives at risk for that reason.
And to situate the events of Saturday in the larger geopolitical story, we have heard recent news stories of North Korea and South Korea coming to an agreement about joint participation in the Olympics, walking under the same flag. What's the context in which this nuclear attack would have been sort of unlikely because of this? The thawing of relations between the two countries seems to make it just a completely out of context event.
Well, there's a three-ring diplomatic circus going on at the present that consists of China and Russia, who have a proposal about ending, trying to get back to the tables by suspending talks and nuclear missile tests. There's the North-South Initiative, and then there's the effort by the United States and its allies to maintain pressure on North Korea, and that was the focus of the meeting in Vancouver, which was of an odd group, the so-called United Nations Command Sending States, which is a rarely invoked and used group, and they met basically to talk about sanctions enforcement, particularly on the naval side. But I think that from President Moon's perspective, the main objective in trying to reach out to the North and to take this initiative was just to guarantee that the games went on without being interrupted by shocks that would have scared away participants and visitors, frankly, and made them more difficult. I think he just wants, in the first instance, to have a successful games. And then to the extent that he thinks that's an opening wedge onto a broader North-South detente, then that's an added plus, continuous threat.
One more question. When you heard the news on Saturday, what occurred? What was your first thought?
My first thought was that it was probably an error.
Mm-hmm.
Because
and why is that?
I think the likelihood that North Korea would engage in a bolt from the blue strike on the United States is really pretty minimal. I mean, first, because I think they do understand the deterrent risks that they face, but also because command and control in North Korea appears to be very, very tightly centralized. And in fact, the regime has gone to great pains to claim that command and control is highly centralized. So the prospect that some rogue commander, some error would have been made, it's not zero, but it strikes me as at least relatively low.
Well, that's comforting.
I think the Korean Peninsula is more stable than people think, because both sides have the capacity to deter the other, and I think mm-hmm. that's kind of understood. I think where the destabilizing elements come in is when you start talking about preventive or preemptive war.
Mm-hmm.
And the North Koreans also sometimes err in this regard. They sometimes talk as if they would preempt. But if you look closely at their statements, it's typically that we would preempt if we felt that we were coming under attack.
Sure.
And so, in fact, their rhetoric with respect to nuclear weapons is more cautious than people think. They're obviously developing a capacity, and we see that as a threat. But nuclear doctrine seems to be oriented primarily around deterrence. I think that the emphasis on the homeland here is kind of misguided in a way, because mm-hmm. we don't know if they have that ICBM capability, but mm-hmm. they certainly have capability within the region.
Sure.
And I think as long as they can hold American military assets in Japan and Guam at risk, it doesn't have the drama of holding the United States mainland at risk. And they also always talk that language. But if mm-hmm. you think about it, it's really adequate to serve their purposes.
Yeah,
as long as they can undertake strikes on Guam and military forces in mm-hmm. Japan, that's all they need to do.
So that's actually a very interesting point to dig into. So what do you think the likelihood of the U.S. engaging in or invoking collective self-defenses versus sort of a straightforward preemptive or, you know, regular sort of white bread self-defense? Because if a strike happened in Japan, I think we probably would invoke the right of collective self-defense.
Well, certainly, because the U.S.-Japan alliance mm-hmm. is really not an alliance. It's a unilateral security guarantee. Mm-hmm. So if Japan were struck, then obviously the United States would be forced to respond.
Sure.
I mean, we've said that. And despite the initial concerns about the integrity of the alliances during the campaign, mm-hmm. you saw this pattern after Trump came to office of what I call assurance tours, mm-hmm. where Mattis and Tillerson and then the vice president and then the president himself in November basically marched through Tokyo and Seoul and said, no, we're committed to the alliances and we're committed to Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Treaty in mm-hmm. particular. So I think that if there was such an attack, the United States would respond, and it would probably be not just a response, but it would be the initiation of a war plan that would seek to defeat North Korea altogether, basically to change the regime. So there you're on a terrain of basically, you know, unlimited mm-hmm. war with regime change objectives.
Do you have any reason to believe that approach to the alliance will change?
I don't think so. I think that basically that what Trump is seeking to do is to bargain when these cost-sharing agreements come up. I mean, we currently have two cost-sharing agreements with Korea and Japan that are in train right now. They're five-year agreements, so you can't change them in the middle. But when they come up, I suspect there'll be some bargaining at the margins about cost sharing, but these are small amounts of money. I don't see the alliances as being fundamentally troubled by a Trump presidency. If anything, they actually seem to have deepened, partly mm-hmm. because of the North Korean threat.
Juliet, you're in a unique position to comment about the events on Saturday from the perspective of state operations and federal operations. I wonder if you can give the audience a bit of your background, tell a bit of your story that explains why you have that unique perspective in both arenas.
So I have been a state Homeland Security advisor and then moved to the federal space as Assistant Secretary for Intergovernmental Affairs at DHS, which means I was sort of the point person for the 50 states. And so basically how it works is we live in a country with divided government, and federalism is still alive and strong and well. So each state has its own emergency management apparatus, and that includes generally a state emergency management agency run by, a director and reporting to the governor. So, and each of those states, working with localities and cities in that state, will sort of oversee emergency management operations. So every disaster begins local. So think, think D.C. So the D.C. emergency management people would deal with the issue. If their capacity gets overwhelmed, then neighboring jurisdictions will come in and help. And if that gets overwhelmed, then the state comes in. And if that gets overwhelmed, then FEMA comes in. FEMA is not, there's only about 2,700 people that work at FEMA. It is not an army. It is a sort of organizing entity that can just bring the resources of the federal government to help when there's local or state disasters. So what happened is basically the state of Hawaii was upgrading based on, from what we know, we should be clear here, from what we know now based on statements made, was doing what every state emergency management agency should do, which is upgrade systems, make sure that they are relevant in whatever the harm may be. And Hawaii worries more about, worries as much about tsunamis as it does, or as it had with missiles. And that there was this terrible error, which we could go into. And so while there's a lot of politics about what's going on, and something I think to be learned about the federal government's response to what happened in Hawaii. This was truly an error coming from a state emergency management agency. And if that error was bad, the gap in them fixing it, this 38 minutes or so until they sent out a sort of never mind text alert, the 38 minute gap is to me the sort of unforgivable part, right? And so lots to learn in terms of how these systems work. But everything, it's normal, right, for states to test their systems. They want to see if they have enough capacity. They want to make sure that the networks are working. There was something to learn of what happened in Hawaii. Apparently, some carriers delivered the text, others did not. Those are, some silver linings coming out of it. And that this goes on, unbeknownst to most of us, until there's a mistake, this is going on a daily basis at most emergency management agencies. So different pieces at different times, but this was sort of solely on Hawaii as regards the original, mistake and the failure to remedy it in time.
Insofar as postmortems or investigations are concerned, I know the FCC has announced that they're going to conduct an investigation, and the president has said something somewhat ambiguous about how this is a state thing, but the federal government's going to get involved now. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what a federal investigation and a state investigation might look like.
Okay, so the investigation will begin on the state side only because it's the governor is demanding it, and one of the aspects of this that we sort of need to focus on is the result of this is people's lack of confidence in a system that you need them to have confidence in. In other words, the next alert that says a tsunami's coming, you don't want, and if it's real, you do not want everyone saying, oh my God, there they go again, right? So part of this review process is, of course, reestablishing confidence in a system that will save lives when it's working well. And so that review should go on. So it seems to me, and once again, I always like to wait for reviews, but I think just based on what people are saying publicly, what officials are saying publicly, that a system upgrade did not have, one would say protections in the system, dual authentication, whatever it is, to ensure that this could not happen, that this kind of alert, a real alert, could not happen. And then understanding that gap in time, Hawaii Emergency Management knew within a second that they had made a mistake because they received the text, right? That they're looking at their own phones. And the gap had something to do with a very clunky governance system that took some time for them to remedy. The good news is the military on the federal side notices what's happening, knows it's fake because they would be the ones who knew if missiles were coming in or not, and immediately tries to get the message out. So there's actually that sort of a fail-safe system in place. I think on the federal side, I don't think there's going to be, honestly, like the feds say, oh yeah, we'll review it, we'll make sure. This is, that's sort of nice to say, but I don't think that there's much that they can do, mostly because the FCC really deals with capacity issues and sort of making sure that the communications are going out strongly. I will say, and where I will ding the federal government as well, tremendous quick outreach and communications by NORAD and Pacific Command. We have now learned that an administration that is over a year old has yet to do a principal's full level exercise with dealing with the very threat that they've been telling us to worry about. Apparently, the highest they've done is a deputy's, that's the deputy secretaries of each agency. Secretary Kelly, who is now the chief of staff, John Kelly, never did one. The new Secretary of Homeland Security, Nielsen, has not done one. So that means that if this had been real, you'd have relatively young and inexperienced, to government at least, members of the president's senior team working with, a lot of cabinet secretaries who have not, don't come from my world, don't come from Homeland Security, trying to play out a real-time event. To me, that is where you can criticize, not politically, just criticize, look, this is, an administration that has been there a year. Most administrations do that during the transition. I think there was one done during the transition for the Trump team, but certainly you're doing it twice a year in most administrations.
That's a good segue into another set of questions I wanted to ask you about preparedness. as someone who's done a lot of work on the academic and the practical, the government side of emergency preparedness, I wonder what you thought about how Hawaii reacted to the events and how the federal government reacted.
That's a great question. And it's like, you know, hard to tell people, like, how do you prepare for a nuclear missile launch? So people in Homeland Security tend to talk about preparedness is not about a particular threat, even though because that tends to be honest, it tends to paralyze people into inactivity. So, you know, for years after 9/11, people like me spoke in a way that made the American public either tune out or freak out, right? Like, there was like no options in between. And I think if you look at the trajectory of Homeland Security, while 2001 sort of created this idea of, okay, well, the homeland could be under attack, how do we protect the American population? 2005 was really what we called the course correction, and that was Hurricane Katrina, because it really told those of us in the space and you know, local state planners that, you know, that a country that was too focused on, you know, stopping 19 guys from getting on 4 airplanes essentially was not able to help an American city from drowning. So so since then we've talked and in terms of all hazards. So how would you think about an all hazards approach for the American public, which is essentially don't let the perfect be enemy of the prepared. And so what we urge is an all-hazards approach to preparedness for the American public. And that includes, obviously, communications in terms of, do you know what you would do if something happened? Have you communicated with your family, with your kids, you know, age-appropriate communication? The FEMA recommends, if you have the means and the resources, what they call 72 on you. That would be, can you have water and food in your home for 72 hours under some assumption that maybe it could take that long? That's a worst-case scenario, I say. You know, I say if you can do 24, we're happy. That means, and I'll get really specific here, that means 1 gallon per person per day. It's not that hard. So I have a family of 5. It's 15 gallons of water in the basement. Not a big deal. And so we try to make it, you know, and then food and medicines or whatever you might need for your home. The other thing is what we've seen in disasters in terms of preparedness is also the most important thing is, can you rebuild after? So assuming that you survive, your family survives. And the biggest thing is, of course, your personal papers. A lot of us, and people laugh at this, but it's true. We all have copies of birth certificates, passports, social security cards. We tend to have those copies next to the originals. That does not help. So I do recommend to people they take pictures of it, put it in the cloud, mail it out of state, whatever, and just because if you have to restart your life. So people can get paralyzed by sort of how overwhelming it can be. And so what those of us in the field have tried to do is try to sort of like just be like, you know, what are the sort of rational things that you wish you would have done if there was some disruption to the system on a missile attack or nuclear attack? People need to remember you can survive. It's the radiation that kills if you are outside. So as people in Hawaii know and elsewhere, and we certainly were a country that knew this at one stage until after the Cold War, try to duck and cover and isolate yourself. And we need to build some of that capacity back into, at the very least, Hawaii's planning.
One more question about the 38-minute gap in notification that this was a false alarm. So as someone who has family in Hawaii, I was on the phone with my family members, and the first notification that any of us saw that this was a false alarm was from Tulsi Gabbard's Twitter feed. I wonder if you have any thoughts on the role that she played, considering that she wasn't a part of the emergency management system.
Yeah, I mean, I know some people have been critical of her about that. You know, I mean, look, she does have a background in this space. She's a veteran, and she certainly had access points to the military to confirm it. So I think, you know, in an ideal world, you have a much more formalized incident command and incident communication system, because if she was wrong, either way, right? I mean, in other words, what if she sent something out saying I've heard there's missiles coming? That's almost, you know, that's worse, right? You know, you want to try to keep it in the incident command. This was a situation in which everyone lost confidence because they knew it was not accurate and it hadn't corrected itself within a minute. I mean, that's what I couldn't believe. I kept sitting there going, we all know it's fake. What is going on here? So ideally, no, because you don't want all sorts of injects into what should be a system that people have confidence in. But I'm, you know, certainly not going to criticize her trying to get her citizens to calm down. Now, as I said, the most important thing is, and I'm glad to see it, I will commend them after being quite critical of them, is to come out open up the windows, figure out what happened, be honest, make the personnel changes you need to make, and get people to have confidence in the system, because we need that system to get people to move. My fear is not that, you know, this was an extreme case, but your biggest fear as someone who worries about catastrophe and saving American lives is no one's listening. We're telling them to evacuate and they're not. We're telling them the hurricane's coming and to leave the coast, they're not. So I want to get confidence in the system, because you got to move people quickly sometimes to save lives.
And then I spoke to Paul Rosenzweig to get his perspective on the federal government's response to the events in Hawaii. I asked him to share a bit of his background first.
By way of background, I was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security from 2005 to 2009 under President Bush. The policy directorate had responsibility for all sorts of DHS activities, the policies behind them, ranging from terrorism to state and local grant making to emergency response. Indeed, one of the very first things that was on my plate when I was there was a retrospective analysis of the failures that had occurred during the response to Hurricane Katrina, which is widely regarded as not a terribly good example of how to go about emergency management. And Congress engaged itself in a very significant response. The post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act, happily known as PCEMRA, that was also part of the responsibilities that the policy directorate had back when I was there. So that's by way of background. By way of structure, what we've seen is not terribly surprising, which is that most of what America's emergency response system is a system of federated response systems that try and bear the greatest responsibility, the closest one can come to the problem, and invoke higher levels of responsibility and authority and response only when catastrophes get to be larger. So, for example, if there's a fire in your house, you call the city, right? You don't invoke state and federal responsibility to respond to that kind of emergency. And as the catastrophe gets bigger, the level of responsibility and authority moves up the chain. One of the decisions we've made long ago is that the emergency communication system is generally managed at the state level. So that's why Hawaii was in the process of conducting a state response. You heard Gene say, for example, that they have tsunami responses, right? That's why Hawaii is responsible for that, because you don't need to get a federal government involved when it's a Hawaii-specific event like that. And certainly you don't want to have a tsunami alert that also covers Kansas, which doesn't have that sort of problem. So that's the way, that's the reasoning behind the level setting for responsibility for things like the emergency communications and warning system.
How big of a mess up was this?
Well, let's put it this way. It certainly was a unique occurrence. It isn't often that an entire state thinks it's about to be the subject of a nuclear weapons attack. I haven't plumbed the history, so I couldn't say that never happened back in the 50s and 60s. It may very well have, but I certainly don't know it. But what I certainly know is that it's a unique and new occurrence in the modern era, in the post 9/11 era for sure, and as such, it's a pretty significant and a substantial error. You've heard how it disrupted an entire state, but we've also seen that it was really the product not so much of just human error, but a bad interface design. Any system that has the actual warning on the same drop-down list as the drill, and that doesn't require like two-factor authentication or two people to say, yes, it really is an attack, but just says, are you sure? And you click through yes. Yeah, that's not a system that's designed well. So to a large degree, I feel pretty sorry for the employee who did this, And he was as much a victim as, he wasn't as much a victim as the people of Hawaii, but, you know, his mistake was pretty understandable. Well, I mean, here's the thing, right? In the normal course, this is not how it would work. It would be that, like, NORAD would issue an incoming ballistic missile alert, and that would get propagated down. So there isn't really a mechanism for anticipating that a state announces that it's the object of an incoming nuclear attack in a situation where the federal government doesn't already know that that's the case. That's just a disconnect that isn't built into the system, because it's a circumstance that we don't anticipate actually being the case in the real world, that Hawaii would have a raid warning from North Korea that was not also already on the federal government's screen. So the lack of a rapid federal response here, the lack of engagement from the president and from DHS and DOD is not actually terribly surprising to me. In fact, the only thing that was really missing here was a way for the federal government to reach back down and say, no, you got it wrong. You know, revert, say no, take it back, you know, kill this. And that could have gone more smoothly. But again, it's something we didn't really, you know, anticipate, right? This is kind of like not expecting planes to fly into big buildings before 9/11, right? It's just not on our radar screen, not to make a pun.
And what about the federal government's response? So I'm sure there were a number of gears turning on the DOD side or the DHS side. Do you have a perspective on how that went?
Absolutely. It's both appropriate and necessary. There'll be an after action report both at the state level and at the federal level, and lessons learned. You know, I've just kind of outlined what I think the lessons learned are. I'll certainly be interested in seeing what DHS comes up with after a more formal process, what the communications channels ought to be. It may be that somebody decides that it's so rare and so unlikely to recur that we don't do anything. I'm not sure I would agree with that, but I could see somebody making that argument, and it's possible that it might be the right argument. But for sure, there will be a review and a report on what had happened and an effort at the state and federal levels to ask the question. I mean, one, for example, how many other states have similarly poorly designed interfaces? How, you know, and it might be that in California, it's a wildfire or a flood that gets alerted. In Kansas, it would be tornadoes. In Florida, it'd be hurricanes. But we want to take what we learned from Hawaii and make sure that we don't ever do this by accident in Florida for hurricanes as well. So there's lots of lessons to be learned here.
This is an ideal moment to transition to Garrett Graff's perspective on what might have happened had this been a real launch. So, Garrett, you've done a significant amount of work sussing out the internal federal government processes around disasters like this. What might have happened on Saturday?
Well, so what you would have first seen is that the, you know, U.S. has a highly advanced, you know, many billions of dollar system that theoretically would have noticed the launch almost immediately from space-based systems. And we track ballistic missiles and launches of any kind, rockets or otherwise, from both space-based systems and land-based systems. And so that warning would have been transmitted first to NORAD, which sort of oversees air defense across North America. It's a joint Canadian-U.S. facility headquartered inside Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado Springs, a mountain bunker dating back to the early 1960s and the height of the Cold War. And that warning would have also gone almost simultaneously to Pacific Command, which is based in right there in Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. And it would have taken them, 3 to 5 minutes to identify the trajectory of the inbound missile and to transmit that warning to the Hawaiian emergency operations center if the missile was in fact headed to Hawaii. And that, remember, sort of what happened was that actually Hawaii, because it was accidental alarm, started at the state level, whereas the first official notice, and really the only way for there to be an official notice, would have started with the federal government and the military. So that would have been transmitted to the Hawaiian Emergency Operations Center, which is itself located in a bunker on the edge of a volcano outside Honolulu. The bunker actually dates back to World War One, World War Two, sort of ammunition storage and artillery shelters, and that have been, you know, updated and modernized over the years to serve as the emergency operations center for the state. And from there, you would have seen exactly what played out, which is that alarm would have gone out over, sort of a number of different systems. There's the emergency alert system, which is what you would have seen on your television screens, as people in Hawaii did. There's the wireless emergency system, where that alarm goes up on people's smartphones. And then there's a number of other emergency alert systems that would have been activated, including alerts going out over maritime radio, for instance. And people in Hawaii would have had 15 to 20 minutes at a maximum, perhaps as little as 12 to 15 minutes of notice. And this is where, the Hawaiian incident, as unfortunate and as terrifying and as scary as it is, there actually is an opportunity created by it to have a more serious and important conversation about what people should actually do in the event of a nuclear exchange with North Korea. Because it's a very, and Juliet talked a little bit about this, it's a very different scenario than most people expect. I mean, we have this picture in our mind of nuclear war as being what it was at the Cold War. You're talking thousands or even tens of thousands of nuclear weapons exchanged in a global thermonuclear general war against the Soviet Union. And that's really not the case. That's not the scenario that we would be confronting with North Korea, who we believe, according to sort of the best guess of U.S. intelligence, possesses probably something in the neighborhood of 10 to 20 nuclear missiles at a maximum. And we don't necessarily have a great reason to believe that they have either particularly advanced guidance systems at this point, nor do we necessarily have a great reason to believe that they have successfully mastered the science of reentry, sort of the moment when those missiles arc back down into the Earth's atmosphere, separate into nuclear warheads, and head on their way to the target. That's actually a scientifically an incredibly complex process, and something that we're not necessarily sure North Korea has been able to do successfully. One of the other aspects in this that is very much an unknown and X factor is the U.S. has a ballistic missile interceptor program, a series of missiles based in places like Alaska that could attempt to intercept a missile that is on its way towards U.S. or North American territory. Again, though, we don't necessarily have much reason to believe that that system would actually work. Intercepting a missile is an incredibly complex problem of its own. You're sort of, as people in the business say, trying to hit a bullet with a bullet, which is an incredibly complex mathematical challenge. And so if a missile did make it through our ballistic missile shield, which we unfortunately have almost every reason to believe that it could, you're likely looking at what would be a relatively limited set of impacts. And this is where, again, I think sort of people misunderstand the scenario that an incident like this would actually likely entail, which is almost everyone would survive. A missile landing even in the center of an urban area, whether it's Honolulu, Los Angeles, Seattle, or even Manhattan, at the level of a weapon that North Korea possesses, which we believe is sort of roughly in the 10 kiloton range, which is approximately equivalent to the bombs that the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. That weapon has a blast radius of about a half mile, which is obviously a huge amount on the one hand, but not sort of the world-ending, city-ending catastrophe that we might expect from sort of our mental image of what would have happened during the Cold War.
And what would this have looked like on the presidential side? Had this been an actual launch, how would the president have been informed, and what would have happened afterwards?
Yeah, so one of the things that we often forget is that sort of all of these shiny toys of the imperial presidency, Marine One, Air Force One, the armored motorcades, effectively grew up during the Cold War as a way to ensure that the president of the United States, wherever he is, anywhere on the surface of the planet, or up in the air, is able to launch nuclear weapons from wherever he is. And so just a few steps from the president at all times, 24 hours a day, is that black briefcase that we call the nuclear football. And it's carried by a rotating set of five military aides, and one of them is always on duty around the president. If the president gets on an elevator, the nuclear football gets on the elevator with him. If he's out on the golf course, the third golf cart behind the president carries the military aide with the football. And so wherever he is, as it turned out, President Trump was, when this drill went down, out on the golf course. So that military aide would have come forward with the football, and the president would have had the opportunity to initiate a retaliatory strike. And the president, on his person, carries what's known as the nuclear biscuit, which is a sealed set of authentication codes that identifies him to the military chain of command, what's known as the National Command Authority, that he is, in fact, the legal president of the United States. And so he would have called, depending on the exact scenario, he would have likely called either the Pentagon's National Military Command Center in Washington, D.C., or he would have called the alternate National Military Command Center, which is a bunker inside Raven Rock Mountain outside Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, which is sort of the backup Pentagon in the event that something happens to Washington. Depending on the scenario, he could have also, for instance, called Strategic Command in Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska, directly. Strategic Command being the part of the U.S. military that oversees the nuclear triad, your nuclear missile submarines, your nuclear ICBM missiles inside their silos, and then your nuclear bombers like the like the B-52s, and that those nuclear weapons would have been readied for use. Inside that nuclear football, that black briefcase, there is not anything like what we sort of picture from, you know, popular culture. It's not a, you know, retina scanner or a, you know, fancy computer with, you know, fingerprint or palm scanners. What it is it's a series of briefing binders. And it's sort of pre-selected, pre-designated nuclear war scenarios that one military aide called a Denny's menu. It's effectively sort of pictures and charts that a president could point to and say, you know, that's the type of nuclear war that I want to order. And there are sort of different gradations, obviously, of a nuclear retaliatory strike, depending on, you know, what he wants to target. You know, are you just going after military command centers? Are you going after cities? Are you going after command and control facilities of the civilian government? And then, you know, who's your adversary? You know, are we trying to attack Russia? Are we trying to attack China? Are we trying to attack North Korea? And all of that thinking has been done in advance by planners at the Pentagon and sort of boiled down to these options that go into the football so that the president isn't sitting there under pressure trying to respond in that 15 to 20 minute window and starting from scratch. And at some level, this might be just the president making his own decision under pressure, you know, under unbelievable, unimaginable pressure. Or it might be that, you know, happenstance allows the opportunity for sort of more wide reflection and gathering of comments. I mean, again, sort of one of the differences, and in fact, a very important difference, again, between the scenario that we might face with North Korea and the scenario that we long expected with sort of Cold War general thermonuclear war, is that there's no expectation that North Korea would be able to have effectively any impact on our retaliatory capability. So unlike an all-out Soviet strike, where part of the reason for acting quickly is so that you can launch your missiles before they're destroyed in their silos or before the bombers are destroyed on the ground, you know, we have every reason to believe that we could do whatever we decide to do to North Korea, you know, hours, days, weeks after they launched an attack on us. And so, you know, there is a chance that the president might take some time to reflect. But there may also be, for instance, a push if North Korea launches one or two missiles to try to strike very quickly in the hopes of disabling any additional missiles you know, stopping them from attempting to attack more cities, whether that's in the United States or countries like Japan. Yeah, I think there are two things that make this substantially different. And just to step back with a moment of context, nuclear false alarms are actually a terrifyingly regular part of the seven decades that we have lived since the invention of nuclear weapons. And they have mostly unfolded out of public view, which it doesn't necessarily mean that they have been any less serious or scary. You know, actually during the Carter administration, we suffered sort of two very serious false alarms that saw actually the national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, awoken in the middle of the night and told that there were 2,200 Soviet missiles on their way towards the United States, and that he needed to wake the president to launch a retaliatory strike. You know, that looked very real. It turned out to be a terrible computer glitch at the time. But, you know, in some ways, that was actually an even more serious false alarm than what we experienced on Saturday, because it actually was an alarm that went up through the ranks of the people who would launch the response. The Soviet Union has suffered some of their own surprises and false alarms. There was a notable one in the 1980s when it looked like, according to their air defense radars, that we had launched nuclear weapons, nuclear missiles against the Soviet Union. Then actually there was another one where an air defense radar sort of accidentally picked up something coming up over the horizon, thought it was incoming nuclear missiles, and they gave Boris Yeltsin, who the president at the time, their equivalent of the nuclear briefcase, which is also a black briefcase called the Chiget, actually sort of started the process preparing a retaliatory strike before they realized that that was also a false alarm. The two things that I think make this so substantially different is one, that this was a public-facing error, that this was a false alarm that went out to an entire state, which is something that is very much unprecedented. Then I think the second is the extent to which social media and connectivity has made this took that Saturday alarm and so rapidly translated it and transmitted it across the rest of the country. That was something that was not the case a decade or two ago. So sort of the entire nation lived that alarm on Saturday in a way that no one nationally has ever lived a false alarm before.
And lastly, I asked our guests to answer the question, does this have anything to do with Donald Trump? Here's what they said.
Well, obviously not in an operational sense, but again, I think it's worthwhile to distinguish between what happened with respect to the mistake and how the public responds to these type of things, because some announcements that are obviously an error are deemed obviously an error by people quite quickly. And what's striking about this event was the plausibility that this might occur among the public. And so to the extent that the president has been dampening those tensions and trying to pursue a diplomatic course, he's had a positive effect, but he's also had the opposite effect when he suggests that the United States might in fact pursue a military course, which of course would have made such a strike at least plausible in the minds of the public.
Except to the extent that the people of Hawaii might actually have given it slightly more credence because of the tensions that have been created between the United States and North Korea by virtue of President Trump's actions. The president had nothing to do with that. And frankly, even in a world in which President Trump didn't exist or he hadn't talked about North Korea at all, the people of Hawaii, the state of Hawaii, would almost certainly have reacted just the same way to a formal warning from the state that there are incoming missiles.
I don't think it's a significant factor in this. As Paul mentioned, what it seems pretty clear is that this was basically a user interface error by the way that the Hawaiian emergency operations were set up, that sort of people were clicked the wrong thing, and that there was a user design that frankly made it really easy to click the wrong warning. If you look at that screenshot of sort of what the drop-down menus were, it's almost surprising that this was the first time that has occurred.
You want to test systems, whoever the president is, and you actually want to test systems based on the geography of the place that you're in. So, here in Massachusetts, we don't test earthquake systems. In California, you better, right? But we test ice storm systems, right? And we test hurricane systems. And so Hawaii is very smart to have been testing that system, whether Trump, is president or not. It is clear that the increased tension led to Hawaii knowing two things. One is it had to upgrade its emergency alert system, and two, it has started sort of a more active public education campaign in terms of sheltering in place and sheltering. Those are clearly attributed to, changes in policy or sort of a more aggressive or, one might say, chaotic sort of approach to the North Korea issue than President Obama had. But I think others can answer that better. I mean, what I say is, in the history of Homeland Security, it used to be it was called something different. It was called domestic preparedness or civil defense. But, there was a time when every kid had to watch, Bert the Turtle and learn about how to survive a nuclear war and duck and cover. Those civil defense mechanisms, atrophied over time. We then live in the post 9/11 world where no one's quite, people tune out or freak out, and we need to just sort of begin to stabilize it as part of just the vulnerabilities of our nation.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare podcast, share it on Facebook, Twitter, offer someone a free Poke Bowl if they listen, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.